I want to make
Mr.
sure.
Mr. President, can you let him finish, sir?
You question put is, a lot of the new question Supreme is, Court justice, the radical question, left.
Will you shut
who is
up,
your,
screwing
no,
things
no, no.
up?
You were a senator.
You're
and
the
by
worst
way, you
president
vice,
America has ever had.
Are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups sure. and to say that they need to stand down and not
white
supremacists and right
Proud
militia?
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. To quote former anchorman Dan Rather after the debate, people in America need to take a shower after hearing all that. And here's what struck me. Trump has in the past and in the debate and continues after the debate to lay the groundwork to discredit the U.S. election. Because to steal a good line, he will put a bullet in the country before he gives up power. Columnist Thomas Friedman, who I know, wrote, "Our democracy is in danger, more than since the Civil War, more than after Pearl Harbor, more than during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're seeing the greatest voter suppression enterprise ever mounted in this country, led by the President of the United States," he said. Because there are so many mail-in ballots, which typically feature Democratic voters, by the way, which won't have been counted on election night, Trump will try to claim victory. And then he'll use the Supreme Court to try to reject those ballots, and the fight could go on for months. A bipartisan open letter signed by nearly 500 national security leaders, including such noteworthy names as former defense secretaries from both parties, two former national security advisors, a number of past secretaries of the military service branches, and various members of the intelligence agency brass, has been written endorsing Democrat candidate Joe Biden. Because they essentially fear that the nation is in peril. Here's one of them, General Chuck Boyd, retired, former Vietnam prisoner.
I spent 36 years in the United States Air Force, almost seven of those as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Since my return, I've been a Republican, but quietly. I fervently believe that military officers should not get involved in presidential politics, even when retired. But this year is different. Donald Trump's assault on the rule of law, which makes a democracy possible, has been so egregious, I've decided to speak out. We have an alternative. If we want a working democracy in 2024, we need to vote for Joe Biden this year.
On this backstory, a couple of those who signed that letter on why. Is it really that dire in the America of 2020? Let's go to California now. And Rose Gottemoeller is a distinguished lecturer at Stanford at the Center for International Security and Cooperation. Before that, Rose, you were the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. You were the Undersecretary for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, where I know you from, and the Chief Negotiator on the Strategic Arms Control Treaty, which, in case most people don't know, governs more than 90% of the weapons on the planet, nuclear weapons on the planet. Rose, you signed this letter along with about 500 former military officers, security people. It doesn't seem, and I've known you for a while, this doesn't seem like something that you would normally do. You tend to stay out of politics.
That is very true, Dana. I think of myself as being a technocrat and someone who focuses on the technical details and trying to get policy right. And that's always been the way I've thought about my role. But I will also say that this is a moment where people need to step forward. And I think you will see among the military officers, the diplomats, the security specialists who've signed this letter that there are a lot of people like me, people who have felt it their duty to stay out of politics, to be the military leaders, the technocrats, that now people are saying Trump is unfit for office and we need to do what we can do to ensure that Joe Biden is elected the next president.
Why is he unfit for office?
Well, there's a lot of evidence out there, the most recent being Bob Woodward's book. And for me, the most heartbreaking thing is his treatment of the coronavirus. pandemic and how he seemed to realize way back in January how serious this was going to be. And yet he kept talking it down to the American people. He said again yesterday, we are beating this virus. We are over it. We've reached the peak. And all the experts say here in the United States that we have not reached the peak and in fact could be facing another very bad bout this winter with the flu season coming on. So, you know, the man is really irresponsible and does not talk the truth to the American people.
I was just listening to, I mean, I went down that list and looked at some of the names, and there are some a lot of very impressive people on there. And I was just listening to a video that a retired general, Chuck Boyd, made, who was an Air Force general, and he's a former Vietnam prisoner, Republican for life. And he said, we may not, if you don't vote for Biden, have a working democracy in 2024. Now, is that melodramatic, or do you really think that's what's on the line?
It's what's keeping me awake at night these days, Dana. You mentioned my long work on nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons arms control. They don't keep me awake at night because I do feel like we and the Russian Federation have worked hard over the years, Soviet Union earlier, to put these systems under control and to deter each other, to have a balance so that we are deterred from trying to strike each other, thank God, with these horrific weapons. They don't keep me awake at night. What keeps me awake at night is the thought that in 2024, our democracy could be damaged profoundly. And that is truly a worry that I have at this time.
Trump has said when he was questioned about a peaceful transition of power, we'll see. He's questioned mail-in ballots. And this sounds like a president who's bent on keeping power regardless of the election results. Or do you think the media is making too much of that? Do you think that once the numbers come in, if it's convincing, or if it takes a couple of weeks to count all the postal ballots, that, you know, Trump's bluster will go away and he'll accept the result? Or do you think he may not?
Trump is clearly a great showman, and he loves to keep the audience guessing. And so he'll always do the ultimate to keep the news cameras focused on himself, to keep the news cycle focused on himself. And I do think that's part of what is at work here. And he started it with his debates with Hillary Clinton way back in 2016. We're having our first presidential debate here tonight in the United States, and we will see how it goes. I'm very much hoping that, of course, it will go well for Joe Biden. And I think he will certainly be well prepared. But the point is, Trump will repeat these kinds of things again and again. But at the core of my concern is the fact that he has no regard for the rule of law, and he has no regard for the Constitution of the United States. So where I take comfort at the moment is in the fact that the Republican congressional leadership has stepped forward, including Mitch McConnell, who has been a great ally of Trump so far as leader in the Senate. But he has stepped forward and said, we will have a peaceful transfer of power. And I think that these are important messages and give some comfort. But still, the bottom line is Trump does not believe in the Constitution or the rule of law.
I'm shaking my head that I'm even asking you about it, because I would interview you in Moscow before at the Carnegie Center, and we would talk about Russia's democracy and ballot stuffing and were the elections real and would Putin, you know, give up the vertical power. And suddenly we're talking about it in America. What does that say about the center, the system, that you can have a president in there who maybe we've never encountered a personality like this before? I think that's fair to say. Is the personality strong enough to derail the system? I thought the checks and balances in American democracy were so much stronger.
It's shocking, isn't it, how quickly we could come to look like Putin's Russia, or some here, even in the United States, are recollecting the 1930s in Germany. I won't go that far. I do think that our system of checks and balances has strength to it that now will have to prove itself. There's just no question about it, which is again why I take comfort from the strong words that are coming from Capitol Hill from our congressional leaders, including on the Republican side. And of course, our court, the Supreme Court, is keeping quiet about this. That's right and proper. And the fact that, you know, Trump is working hard to put his appointees on the court and to make sure that there is a majority of a more conservative hue. But nevertheless, I do believe that the court would stand up for U.S. constitutional prerogatives as well. And the appointee who has been put forward by President Trump is one who says that she takes a very strict reading of the Constitution. So I would hope, even if she should be already on the bench at the time of such a crisis in January, that in fact she too would be standing up strongly on behalf of the Constitution.
I hope you're right, Rose. I mean, it's startling to me that we could have chaos on election night with two different candidates for the presidency claiming that they were the winners and, you know, some kind of stalemate that could go on for weeks and weeks and potentially, you know, a month or two.
I think the experts have been right, Dana, to underscore the importance of not focusing on election night per se, because of the fact, and it's right and proper with all the pandemic raging in different parts of the United States, including in the Midwest these days, which was spared earlier, but now sadly is suffering its own share of hotspots in my own state of Ohio and up in the upper Midwest and Wisconsin and so forth. So
people don't want to go out and vote in that environment.
Exactly. They want to be safe. They want to cast their ballot by mail, and that is right and proper. The president himself casts his ballot by mail in Florida. And so I think it will be important that people do not either panic or rush to judgment on election day, but wait and let the ballots be counted. It could be several days afterwards. This is normal enough, and I've seen it across the democracies in Europe now as mail-in voting and other forms of voting have taken place during this pandemic, that sometimes the word is not there on the actual election day. It takes a few more days or maybe a week. But in any event, that's the message that's coming through clearly from the experts here. Don't focus so much on election day. We may not know for several days or a week or maybe 2 weeks who actually will be the president of the United States.
As a great, you know, watcher of history and politics, political science, here's a media question for you. What should the media, you know, people like me, what should we be doing on election night? Because if it's clear the results are unclear, we shouldn't be carrying claims to victory, or should we?
Well, far be it from me to advise the media
what
to do, but I would just take that same caution that I just articulated. That is that it will be important to see carefully how many votes have actually been counted, not how many votes have been cast by the time we reach midnight on November 3rd, and then say, all right, let's stand back and wait and see where the final vote comes in. It will be very unsatisfying for the media, I know. And I have heard several express frustration here in the United States that it's not going to be the same kind of cliffhanger on election night that everybody loves because the ratings are so great. But I think it will be important to let the process unfold, and it will take some time.
A couple of quick questions, and then I'll let you go. In your role at NATO, you no doubt have been to these moving ceremonies in Normandy and in France for World War I and World War II. Do you believe the reports in The Atlantic that Trump, when he was supposed to go to a memorial service in 2018, said, I'm not going to go and honor those losers?
Oh, Dana, it's so hard to believe that because they're such horrible remarks. But I will say, I was at NATO at that time. It was the 100th anniversary of the end of World War II in 2018. I was the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. All of us, the leaders of NATO, both civilian and military, were fanning out because there were many, many ceremonies. And Belgium is, you know, right at the heart of where World War I was fought. And so it still is a living event for many Belgians and for many Belgian cities. So we were really doing everything we could to represent NATO across these ceremonies. So every one of them was wrenching and really made you realize how great the toll of this war for the countries of Europe. And then when I heard that Trump wouldn't go to the ceremony because he would have to drive in the rain and it would be raining, I was shocked. I thought, really? So I don't know if he made those remarks. I cannot tell that. But I will tell you that I was very shocked at the time that the President of the United States would let a little rain deter him from paying honor to the dead in France. So I was very shocked indeed. And he paid a price. He got a lot of bad publicity out of that. And so that's what he pays attention to. The next day he did head off to another ceremony to try, I think, to make amends. But to my mind, it was too late. He'd already showed that he had no concern or regard for those who had suffered.
Do you have concerns that America could back out of NATO if Trump is reelected?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think NATO has done a great job, and I always give a huge amount of credit to my old boss, Secretary General, rather, Jens Stoltenberg, because he went out of his way, I think, to develop a good relationship with Trump, and really has used Trump to do what the NATO allies have promised to do since 2014, to raise their defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2024.
But Trump is known for ripping up agreements, whether it be the START treaty or whether it be agreements with Russia or, you know, and NATO. I mean, yes, he's put pressure on them, but some people feel he could back out of the support for NATO. I mean, and America is no doubt the strongest pillar.
Well, I'm saying, yes, with Trump, it's not easy to predict the future. There's no question about that. But I will say, I think that his attitude toward NATO is different today than it was when he first came to NATO in May of 2017. And I think now, looking back on that short, we had a one-day short meeting at our new NATO headquarters, and that's when he publicly raised doubts about the U.S. commitment to Article 5. But since that time, I think that his role in raising the defense expenditures in NATO countries has made him feel that, you know, this is something I won on. So I don't think he has the same attitude today as he had back in 2017. We will see if I'm right or not, but I do know that I could see that his attitude was changing. For example, we were in Washington in April in 2019, to commemorate the 75th anniversary of NATO's establishment, 70th anniversary, rather, forgive me. And, you know, Trump received the leadership of NATO in the Oval Office, Jens Stoltenberg. And, yeah, he was, as usual, rough in his criticism, but he was feeling also proud that he'd gotten NATO to pay up.
Maybe he understands the alliance a bit better than he did when he first came to office. Rose Gottmuller, thank you so much. You're always generous with your time, Rose. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dana. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Will you commit here today for a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
And, I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
All right, Lori Sutton is a retired brigadier general in the U.S. Army. She was the Army's highest-ranking psychiatrist and also commissioner of New York City's Department of Veterans Services, and she is also a candidate for the mayor of New York. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Dana. Good morning.
Good morning. And you'll have to tell me, when is the election in New York for the mayor? Is that 2021?
That's 2021. The Democratic primary is on June 23rd, with the general then following in November. But New York City politics being what they are, the primary is really the main event.
All right. Tell me, why did you sign this letter saying vote for Biden? What's the idea of ex-military people who normally do not endorse political candidates doing just that?
You know, these are not ordinary times. And I actually, as a career military officer, I've been studiously nonpartisan, apolitical my entire life, always a registered independent. And I I feel very strongly in this moment, in this time, we have to stand up. We have to stand up, and we have to take stands that wake up Americans, that point to all of the erosions in our institutions, and all of the provisions, the bulwarks of democracy, which I think are at risk here. And so for me to sign up on that letter, it was a very important statement. I wanted my name to be heard, that this is a time for ordinary people to stand up during this extraordinary time and let their views be known.
It's extraordinary to me, watching this from overseas in London, that so many Americans are talking about the threat to democracy. I mean, I've spent my life covering elections in places like Belarus and Russia and Afghanistan and civil wars. And the idea that you're actually talking about it in the American homeland, that your democracy is at threat, is astounding to me. Do you think that there's some melodramatic notion in there, or do you actually fundamentally believe that the democratic process is on the rails?
I fundamentally believe that everything that we have worked so hard to build, and not from a partisan perspective, but from a citizen's perspective, over the last 200 and almost 50 years, could come off the rails in this period of time where, after all, just this week, we saw a debate that was like no other, in which a hate group, a domestic terrorist group, was told to stand by. We have seen time after time elected officials, both in Congress as well as across the country, who have gone back on basic positions that they held, basic standards of decency.
Well, I mean, the whole issue right now seems to be mail-in ballots. I mean, in addition to, you know, Trump firing up militia groups and people who he should be absolutely denouncing and distancing himself from, and I'll ask you that. But right now, he seems to be laying the groundwork for saying that the mail-in ballots, which everybody is relying on, and you're a doctor, would know because of COVID-19, there are going to be a lot of them, and he is going to try to discount them on election night. I mean, that's election chaos.
Well, it's very clear. And I think that we will continue over these next 4 weeks, we will continue to see the seeds of that chaos and that effort to plant seeds of doubt in the minds of Americans as to whether or not their vote will count. And if they do go to vote in person, whether or not they will encounter resistance or intimidation at the poll station.
General Chuck Boyd, a retired former Vietnam prisoner, is one of the people who signed that letter. He's always voted Republican. And I was watching his video where he talked about that if you don't vote against Trump now, you may not, quote, have a working democracy in 2024, unquote.
These are the judgments of seasoned leaders, as you said. These are not political ploys. They're not. This is not an action, certainly, that I or any of the people on that list took with any intention of scoring points or somehow gaining personal advantage or stirring up controversy. It's a time to stand up and be counted. And I think that's what you saw from that list, is very serious people recognizing the gravity of this situation and deciding to take action.
But you're less than 500. And I see some of the comments after you and others of that list of almost 500 have posted their names. You know, a lot of people are saying you don't speak for the military, and you may be a very small percentage of the military, and you don't speak for us, some of them. There were a lot of people there that were applauding your signature as well.
Sure. No, none of us signed that letter thinking that it was going to be a popularity contest, but it's an important discussion to have, an important debate to have. And if it can wake people up to pay attention to what's going on and to make their informed judgments, then it will have been an effort well spent.
Trump in the debate told the Proud Boys, stand back, stand by. How do you interpret stand by?
Well, I think you need look no further than to see how the Proud Boys interpreted it. Immediately on social media, yes, sir, Mr. President, standing by. I think the message is very clear. And it's not just this one message during this particular debate. There have been messages throughout the last 3.5 years. And I think if you look at how Michael Cohen has described the ways in which the president communicates and sends messages,
lawyer, yeah.
It's very clear that this is another one of those instances, which didn't just start this week, but actually throughout, in fact, before the election in 2016.
How much influence did the reports in The Atlantic have on you that suggested, you know, in 2018 in France, that Trump wouldn't go to a memorial calling U.S. soldiers buried their losers?
Well, I'm very disturbed by that report. I will say this, in a time like this moment in which we're living, where the emotions and the divides are so sharp, I think that it would have been better for whoever that source was to either come forward and put that comment on the record or not make it, because I think it's just, it hasn't solved anything. It's just created more division and more dissent and more, frankly, from the president's perspective, more distrust in the media. And so I think that was an unfortunate decision, whoever that person was, that they didn't just come on the record and say directly what it was that they heard purportedly from the president.
I want to give you a bit of a right-hand turn, because it's an interesting question on my part, but it's something that I've thought a lot about, because I've done stories on QAnon and different things that are happening in America right now, and actually some of them are worldwide as well. But because you're in psychiatry, is there a medical explanation, do you think, for this adoption by so many Americans? You know, almost a kind of paranoia, maybe because they've been locked down in COVID-19, that, you know, mainstream media is the enemy. Democrats are, you know, pedophiles, keeping people locked in their basements. The election is being stolen. We have to stand up. And that motivates some of these militia groups as well. I mean, some pretty crazy stuff out there, but with some very big foundations and followings.
Yes. And I think if you go back, I look at the president as a problem, but he's not the problem. I think that the problems that we see now that are really coming to fruition have really been those that have been growing over a period of years. I think, you know, we have on the right, we have a whole segment of the country who over the last 20 years or so have seen their identities sort of be lost. The manufacturing jobs have gone to globalization. They feel disparaged by the elites on both sides of the aisle. Both parties, I think, have been guilty of this. And they feel like the America that they grew up in, they no longer recognize it. And there's an identity issue here that is very, very deep, the vein of resentment and anger and rage that the president has been masterful in tapping into. I think on the left, you see an entire generation. Let's take AOC as an example and the generations that she represents. Their entire living memory of growing up, our country has been at war. They've seen the failures of the financial system in 2008 and 2009. There's been nothing about the free market capitalist system that we fought so hard for years ago as allies. There's been no living memory for them that capitalism, as the most powerful engine for creating wealth that the world has ever known, they have not seen that in operation in a way that would convey confidence or trust. And so I think that leaves us with these two extremes. And you're seeing now with the fear that has been generated, and you know, understandably so, with the COVID virus. And so people are being very reactive as opposed to, you know, being in what we call our resilient zone, where you can respond, where you can think and you can reason. Instead, what you're seeing, both with the advent of cyber bullying and social media and all of those sorts of things, we're living in a world that is bathed, marinated, if you will, in fear and toxic rhetoric that demonizes the other, that demonizes
and disinformation on such a wide scale that, I mean, look, I'm a media person and I think I can generally navigate somewhere close to truth. But it becomes more and more challenging for me as well. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of Americans who are, you know, tapping into that social media, and all of them generally are because they're locked in their homes during a pandemic, and it gets very murky and there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and it's hard for them to understand what is truth and what is not.
Well, and if you look at the history of, you know, fascist movements, authoritarian regimes, revolutions from past history, you see a very common pattern where fear takes root in a society, and that a strong man authoritarian leader will then systematically erode trust in the institutions, in the free press, in the judiciary, and you see all of that. And of course, it's been supercharged by now technology and the ability to connect in real time. But I think if you look at, for example, Putin in Russia has provided an absolute playbook on how to systematically and in a very compressed period of time peel back the institution of democracy and lay bare a very disturbing reality.
Well, the KGB is very good at that, and I don't think they ever had a really good planted democracy, and they kind of looked to the American model. And now a lot of countries that have looked towards American democracy as the model are beginning to question all of that. But coming back to history and those leaders who have taken advantage of that confusion and disinformation, and I mean, you're pretty well saying that President Trump is doing that, that he is laying those seeds and he is also trying to reap the rewards of that.
I think that's very clear.
And that's why this letter of yours sends a message out to people saying what? As people who have been leaders, you're saying what to Americans?
Wake up. Take a look, get informed, decide for yourself. I'm not telling you what to think, but I am saying that from my perspective and my experience, I'm very, very concerned. And I see this as being a real, it sounds cliche, but it's a crucible crossroads for us as a country. And part of the reason, Dana, that I'm running for mayor is that as I have seen these factors and these conditions and these dynamics take root over the last several years, particularly dating back to, 2018, where we, you know, the political system in our country, our city at least, with AOC's victory, just really tore the existing status quo apart. And I watched as career politicians, you know, ran for the far left, trying to curry favor with the DSA, the Democratic Socialist. I saw the rhetoric take on a very charged, cruel, mean, and demeaning tone of demonizing entire industries, of demeaning wealth and the wealthy. And I kept asking myself, as I saw conditions in on the street with increased violence and the seriously mentally ill and all of these factors coming together, and this was even before the pandemic, I said, where's the leadership going to come from that can unify our city and lift us up and move us forward? And I didn't see it. And my bedrock conviction, Dana, is that as our city, as New York City goes, so goes much of our country. And as our country goes, so goes much of our world. And so I feel a distinct call to duty, call to action, to apply every bit of the leadership and the experience that I've gained over the decades since I first started out as a second lieutenant in the Army. And I'm bringing that to bear and giving New Yorkers a choice.
Well, I know brigadier generals and former brigadier generals can move mountains. I've been around them in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I don't underestimate you in any way, but I would just final question to you, and that would be, is there a path back to a more civil America after this election, whether Trump wins or Biden wins and both sides cry foul, and it may be fought in the courts for weeks and potentially months, and it could be fought in the street even and at polling stations. What is the road back to kind of, you know, a more healthy America and democracy?
I think there is a road back. If the president is reelected, I think the message is very clear that the nation will have spoken in favor of law and order, of bringing back safety and security to our streets, to our neighborhoods, to our schools, to our workplaces. If Vice President Biden wins, then we'll be in for another set of challenges. But I will work to bring people together, to find the areas where we can agree on, and that's great, have to be able to come together with respect. I guess that's what I would, as much as anything, want to bring back to the public domain and to the marketplace of ideas and to this incredible city that right now is really, really struggling in search of a champion, in search of a leader who will put the city first. And that's what my life of leadership has been, as a career public servant and as someone who has led in combat, someone who has led during times of extreme life and death circumstances. This is a time, Dana, where our career politicians, many of them just simply lack the capacity to lead in times of life and death crisis. They've never had to do that before. The best of them do have a set of core values which they apply to their personal lives and apply to their professional decisions and public life. But for those who lack that core set of values and convictions, if your lens in leadership has always been the lens of politics, you are woefully unprepared and inept and incapable to lead under these circumstances.
Lori Sutton, great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dana.
And that's our backstory on what's going to be high drama in the U.S. Just in case you haven't already had enough drama this year in your life, more is yet to come. Thanks for listening. Try to keep your sense of humor. I'm Dana Lewis. Subscribe to our podcast, and I'll talk to you again soon.